My name is Chuck Anderson, and when I'm not at Holden Village or riding a passenger train, which are the two things I enjoy doing more than anything else, I work as assistant bishop of the Minnesota Synod Lutheran Church in America. And part of my job is relating to town and country congregations, of which we have, 200 or a few more than that in our synod. And by accident, because there are so many small congregations in the rural area, I became rather interested in the small congregation. Like to spend a little time in four areas. One, discovery of the small congregation, which I would venture is relatively recent, at least as something good. And secondly, we'll try and describe a small congregation, and that is incredibly difficult. That's part of the reason I was asking you what size congregation you had come from. Third, we'd like to talk a bit about the advantages of the small congregation. If we had more time, we could talk about the disadvantages. And the large area in between that is rather neutral, because I really think when all is said and done, the size of the congregation is rather irrelevant, and it's finding out what you can do and do that and not worry about what somebody else is doing in another congregation. And then third or fourth, I hope we can get to some time of discussion. I mentioned that I think that the small congregation has just recently been discovered as something that's good, or at least that there is good in a small congregation. Historically, at least from where I sit, the congregation has been considered bad. It's been a problem, and as a result, churches, denominations, have had major emphases in closing or merging small congregations. And this would be particularly true in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s. And as you come toward the late 60s, a little bit less sure about should the churches, the small congregations, be closed. In our own case in Minnesota, there were about 50 small congregations closed between 1962, which was the year the Lutheran Church in America was formed, and 1976, as recent as that, and there were hundreds back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Now, there have been people interested in rural churches before. In the late 40s, early 50s, there was quite an impassioned attempt by Lutheran denominations, for instance, to sell farms to Lutherans to keep the Catholics out. And after that kind of died out, there was a void, and only recently have there been attempts to take seriously rural congregations. Now, please understand, I don't want to equate small and rural, but the majority of small congregations are rural, particularly so in Minnesota.
What do you define, if you don't mind me asking, as small and the rural, as far as numbers of members?
Yeah, that's the description of a small congregation, which we'll get into in just a moment. Quickly, a few reasons for closing small congregations. I think there were some good reasons, particularly in the time of the Depression. There was a lack of money. There has been a losing of members of population base, particularly in the rural areas and also the inner city. There's been duplication, particularly where there have been mergers, ending up with three congregations in the same synod at the same corner, for instance. The automobile, incredibly important in terms of transportation, don't need all of the churches a mile and a half apart. There was a shortage of pastors. Probably at every point in our history, as American churches, denominations, other than in the middle of the Depression and in the 1970s, at every other point in history, there has been a shortage of pastoral leadership. I'm a little nervous about one more reason, because I think we have been enamored within many denominations with efficiency. And the small church was seen to be inefficient and something to be gotten rid of. The more removed, the better. That was considered progress. When the small congregation was discovered as an asset, I don't know if you want to date something, I'd choose 1968, as recently as that. 1967, the Lutheran Church in America eliminated its last town and country staff person, and that person tended to have the interest of the smaller congregation, both urban and suburban, as well as rural concern. However, 1968, something very interesting began to happen, and it was not anticipated by very many folk. And that was the first year that more people left urban areas to move into rural areas. And that has continued to, I don't know if it's accelerating, is it accelerating, Julie? It is accelerating. We have a demographer and, you know, somebody, a sociologist over here that we can test out our theories on. When the rural to urban population trend was continuing, I would suggest that was the strongest missionary enterprise that our church has ever seen. The planting of urban and suburban congregations by the small church types coming out of rural America. Relative affluence, adequate pastoral leadership, and the relative failure of mergers and closures of churches. Some studies were made in the 60s showing that the rule of thumb for a merger, two congregations joining to become one congregation, the result was a congregation no larger than the largest of the two going into the merger. There was that much dropout. And more frightening than that, if we take seriously our commission to go out and witness the faith, in a church closing, 30% of the members on average, a little more than that even, did not ever join another congregation. So that the attempt to merge and close was less and less thought to be good because of the results. And these are studies that, you know, had a little track record to them. They happen to be Northwestern Minnesota and North Dakota studies, but they, I think, probably might be valid for other areas as well.
Chuck, when you said they didn't join another church, did you actually talk to the people? Were you looking at roles of Lutheran churches? And is it possible they joined a non-Lutheran church? Or?
The studies would seem to indicate that they never again maybe even set foot inside a church. There were so many hurt feelings, so much anger, so much disappointment, so much loyalty to a particular place or symbol or something that was just pulled out of their lives that they just retreated. Now, it could be, you know, even later that they would again join a congregation, but these tend to be the people least interested in uniting with congregations, and we're still dealing with that, and a lot of hurt and fear on the part of the small congregations that didn't survive. Well, I would say basically it was the denominations. It was a top-down kind of decision.
It wasn't just an economic situation with the congregation, but it was...
Some were, and I would say the closer the decision-making process was to the heartbeat of the congregation, the less difficult it was.
Well, right. That's
the more top-down it was, the more difficult. Yeah. See, part of my job now is to go out to some of these small congregations and try and encourage them to live and grow. And they cannot. That there's no way that they can handle that, because for 30, 40 years, synod, church said close. Close is good. We're going to show them, you know. And now we come out, and I can think of a couple congregations where in six trips, they're just starting maybe to, not sure about you, but you maybe even mean what you say. Not sure yet. That's 4 years, you know, of attention and work. And some interesting things. One church council person told me, that was last fall, I guess, that you know, we really kind of liked almost better when you came out and told us to close than to tell us to live, because then we knew where the enemy was. We could identify the enemy. We had some way to be against something. Now you say grow and live, and you got some ideas, and we're not sure we want to do that. Kind of interesting. Very interesting. And of course, there's fear of change, there's fear of growth. The small congregation may be more introverted, kind of an extended family. And almost always, the small congregation has a low self-image. We aren't good because we're not big, kind of thing. We've been told that for years and years and years and years. A few will have a superiority feeling, thinking that they're better, but I find those to be very, very, very unusual. They may tend to be newer congregations. The older the congregation, the small congregation, the more it tends to have a low self-image. In Minnesota, in 1980, in June, Ball Bluff was received as a new congregation, as the only new town and country start, small congregation, no real potential to ever grow, the only one since 1954. So there's a big gap, and we're in a growing state, and Minnesota is growing not in the metro area, it's growing north. Fastest growing retirement area in the nation is northern Minnesota. It's growing southeast along the Mississippi River. Winter is not necessarily bad, and of course a lot of the people are affluent enough to have a home down, you know, someplace where you people live, a lot in Texas. Well, let's quickly move from that least important part of our hour to what is a small congregation? The best answer is that nobody knows, or perhaps nobody agrees. In our staff, two of us that office next to one another can't agree on what a small congregation is. We did a workshop for small congregations, several of them throughout Minnesota, and we argued about who should be invited. And Ron said, let's go maybe 600 members, and I was saying let's go 200 members. We compromised at 400. Last month at the LCA convention, Bishop Crumley said the small congregation is one under 250 members. Tend to think that's going to be the winning statistic, at least for the Lutheran Church in America, though I find it difficult to think of smaller or small as something larger than average. If that makes sense. The average sized LCA congregation is 230 members. And if we're going to say 250, then is small, you know, we're going to have almost two-thirds of our churches in that particular small category. We have a very, very, very hard time yet getting over that small is not bad. We have to make it a little bigger, which means that the smaller congregation still feels less and has some image problems. Some will say small building or less than full-time pastor or comparison with the past would make for small. Some look at worship attendance. That's one of the things I was asking.
I was going to say, just the church roles don't seem to mean that much.
No. Worship attendance, I think, is if you have to come up with one statistic, the one that seems to be most credible is your average Sunday worship attendance. And 25%. Of all churches, all congregations in North America have a worship attendance of 35 or less total on Sunday morning. Half are under 75.
People or percent? You're talking about?
People. Uh-huh. So if you have more than 75 in church on Sunday morning, maybe you shouldn't think of your congregation as small either. 75% are under 140.
That's a great big church.
And 95% are under 350. Now, in that statistic, of course, if you come from Lutheran background, our numbers are higher because our congregations, even though LCA is 230 average, many, many, many denominations have lower average memberships than the Lutheran. We've got some big big congregations that tend to pull the statistics up.
Now go back to the 35 then is what?
25% of all congregations have a Sunday worship attendance of 35 or less.
All congregations in America?
All LCA? Or
no, that would be, this is a study I think of 80,000 congregations in North America. It's America. Almost an all-inclusive, there'd be everything in there, but they would be Christian denominations by somebody's definition. The Methodist statistics now would be lower, the Lutherans would be higher. The Methodists, the Baptists likewise have many, many, many very small churches. Two-thirds of Methodist congregations, for instance, do not have a full-time pastor. Low budget, $30,000 or less, small, some say that. One of the things we must, I think, underscore is that a small congregation is not a small, big congregation. There is no way for a small congregation to become large unless very radical change happens. Now we're talking older congregations, not new established mission congregations that already has some program in terms of how to grow built in. So we can't say a 100 member congregation is one-fifth of a, you know, of a 500 member congregation. It's unique, it's special, it's different. Few of the differences. One would be that the pastor is a shepherd instead of a rancher. A lot of individual, one-on-one kinds of approaches to ministry rather than working with groups that do ministries. Another is that programs and rational logic tends to be less important the smaller the congregation. The smaller it is, the more relationship is important. You can go and try and sell an educational program in a small congregation, and if they don't know you and have trust in you, you're not going to be able to sell it or even give it away, or they'll maybe take it and not use it. The larger the congregation, the more the logical approach and the demonstration of what is thought to be good in the mind of somebody will make sense. And you can see, I think, that denominational programming has tended to lean way over on the side of building a very attractive, logically good approach.
Would that have to do with the attitude or the economics of the church?
Attitude.
Carefully scrutinized when they're working on a lower budget.
Oh yeah, but they'll use that as an excuse.
Oh, is it?
The small congregation can go out and buy an organ in one Sunday. If the need is there, the money comes in. Most do not have a good stewardship program, and don't do that well in routine things. They know they don't have to, but if the furnace goes out or the roof blows off, or they're really committed to a new instrument, they'll do that very rapidly.
I think an example of that is our inner city church in the Bronx. I think raised as much money for hunger as your church
in Worthington. Yeah.
That we compared that year.
That's right.
Was a large one, and they just sort of decided this was going to be the campaign of the year, and the money really came in.
Yeah. If they get sold on something, man, it's done. The larger the congregation, the more redundant, the more necessary it is to read the announcements on Sunday morning that are already printed in the bulletin, for instance.
What we found was that there weren't people in the congregation with skills to draw on to have this kind of rational plan, that people didn't know how to function in the committee. Most of them had been immigrants or didn't have that kind of experience with their work, and they really didn't understand how you carry out these planning processes. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't that there was no money, it's just that they didn't have any of the skills.
Management by objective has come into most denominations, perhaps more than we would want to admit, and that's fine for some things and for some folk, but for others it's more or less left them behind.
I guess first of all, that definition,
pardon?
Just for small of this definition, you have to have special guys for things like new organs. Mm-hmm.
Carl Dudley, I think, has written the best book on the small congregation. I've got it back in my case back there, if any of you want to take a look at it afterward. It's called Making the Small Church Effective. And he, after struggling with definitions, comes up with his own, and he calls the small congregation a prickly bundle of love. not a bundle of love, but a prickly bundle of love. And defines that then as a single self, a single social unit, which would tend to be around 60 to 75 people. Can be as large as 200, it can be much smaller. And uses things like everybody knows the first name of everybody else, all meetings tend to be congregational meetings. Everybody knows everything about everyone. And also that the small congregations tends to be very tenacious and enduring. You can leave it alone, the pastor can have trouble or can leave, and they can kind of be out of favor with the authorities of their denomination, and you can come back 10 years later and it's still going to be 44 members. It replaces members very easily, but it grows very difficultly. It tends to replace from within. Somebody marries into a family. That's safe to bring them into the congregation. But if a black family moves into a white neighborhood, that tends to be more risky. And one of the interesting things that I'm kind of trying to test out, something I just picked up this summer, in the small congregation, the tribal chief, every church has one, is almost always a layperson. In the large congregation, the tribal chief almost always is the pastor, the senior pastor, if there are more than one. The tribal chief, I suppose another word would be the pillar, the controller, the blocker, the one you've got to sell on your program before you can get it in. And in working with small congregations, working with pastors, we're trying to find out ways to help pastors determine who the tribal chief is and use that as an advantage, not something bad. Pastors tend to talk about pillars of the church in negative connotations too often. Running this by real quickly, again, the small congregation would be a single cell. The medium-sized congregation would be multi-cell. The large congregation would be multi-cells that draw in a number of non-members into the cells. The larger the church, the more apt you would be to have youth that were not members of the church in the youth ministry, or non-members within the choir, or non-members within the Bible study group. Let's stop there. We've have a reality test, or what is clear or unclear, what else would you be interested in, please do.
I guess that I'm sort of puzzling whether we're small or medium sized, really. I guess we're probably medium sized by your definition. We're about 450, I think. Remember?
You see, what I would suggest has happened is that you have bought into the smallest bad. So that if you're 450, you're really a very large church. And yet, you know,
but
people don't know it.
Relative to the other Lutheran churches in our community, we're smaller. And I think that's where we get our
small feeling. We're coming to California, and just 10 miles away, there's a Garden Grove mini church of 6,000 members.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that Garden Grove is a denomination.
Well, the people come.
It really functions like a denomination. About all of it, Lutheran, the largest Lutheran congregation in North America is in South Minneapolis. It has 10,400 members. That's kind of a mini denomination.
What?
It really is. Produce their own educational material,
no,
run their own camping
already.
Program, you know, that type of thing. And certainly Garden Grove does. But I'll bet if you'd make an effort, you'd find an awful lot of small congregations too. But somehow the image is from the larger congregations. And I really feel that has affected us in some rather serious ways, at least as I poke around in Minnesota and try and affirm the small congregation. But they have something to offer to Christ, to the community, and to one another. And they're really quite amazed at that.
I would think, Chuck, that one of the more useful definitions would be the concept of the cells, and how many cells are there?
Yeah, I define a cell.
Well, it would be the largest group that, that hangs together as a social group on a one-on-one, first-name basis, intergenerational. Grandma knows the grandson of some other member, that type of thing. You could, I suppose, diagram it and get at it in that regard.
There's a fairly good navigation to us. There's no grandmas, there's no traditional history.
Yeah.
What's a 15, 18 years old?
Yeah. Yeah, and from that regard then too, with that short a history, it would tend not to follow as carefully some of my thesis, because the younger the congregation, the less it's looking like this. A new mission congregation, for instance, won't necessarily come out with these kinds of qualities. A highly mobile one, likewise.
I think it's interesting to follow when you talk about your thesis. But what you're talking about is something unique to the north and central part of the country. And our situation has so many dissimilarities as to make what you're offering a very interesting thing to hear, but not involved in our...
Yeah.
You talk about leadership that develops. You'll generally find a patriarch or a chief or whatever you want to do. We don't have that. I'm sure I think if I were nailed to it, I think we might find a half a dozen that I might identify as that kind of people within our church. Second generation is practically nil. The average American moves, what, every 5.6 years? I think in our community it's down to 2 or 3. Major differences.
Yeah. We would have some of that mobility, but perhaps not as general or widespread.
The one thing you have is community identification, okay? If the guy belongs to whatever, North Dakota, that's identifiable. Now while he was still going to our church, we all went to the same church. You live in Huntington Beach, I live in Westminster, you live in Fountain Down, other people. You know, just all communities all around, there is no geographical identification whatsoever.
Yeah.
And you're talking about places where there is an obvious identifiable geographic...
Yeah, particularly as I draw from the rural area. My perspective is rather narrow. However...
Well, ours is even narrower, but you're dealing with much different than we are.
One of those things... But I'm not sure you're a small church, though.
No, that's what we're finding out.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, by definition, I think it's really basically one cell, if you will, in our church, by one social group. That, I don't think there's more than one, is it?
Probably not. Can I go on beyond what you're saying, though, and just in our own, this is our own thing here, is that I don't deal with on a daily basis in my own world, in secular world, any of the people basically within that church. I mean, I don't see them every day or do business with them necessarily or whatever, because everybody's so scattered. And so the community really is a Sunday morning community.
Yeah.
And even though you have a nucleus of a first-name basis or whatever, it's not, I don't think it's what you're talking about.
There would be some of that in some of the small churches I'm talking about, where they would see people only on Sunday or for church-type activities, but the rest of the week, not. There would be others, again, the more rural churches, where they would tend to associate with one another. But even there, rural America has changed far more rapidly than urban America.
Well, part of what you're talking about was, you said suburban too. You're talking about rural suburban, right?
Well, I'm kind of generalizing in small church, no matter where it is. We tend not to have many small suburban congregations, so I have less places where I've actually tested out these things in suburban
areas, the similarities
city and rural.
Instance is that there's not a big emphasis on outreach, and every time there is a big emphasis on outreach, it sort of kind of dwindles down after a while. And that's what you're talking about, is the main maintenance and some of the status quo, because everything seems okay the way it's running.
Sure. Well, churches of every size have to deal with that issue. So.
I think the comment over here that you were going to tackle with, we're large, not small, I would come back to say maybe we're talking about a different numbering system. If you have a church of 100
people, and there are only 500 people within a 10-mile radius, that might be a great big church. I think we perhaps feel smallness because of the enormous number. You know, Huntington Beach is about 150,000, 200,000 people. Mountain Valley is 100,000. Westminster is 7,000. Barry Grove is 120. Oh, you can't tell one from another. You drive from one and you're
Yeah.
So we feel a smallness perhaps in relation to the numbers of people around us.
Because we're just overwhelmed from it.
Yeah.
When you talk about bigness. But what is a small kind? In that kind of an age, what are we? Mark referred to evangelism. Well, the frustration of an evangelism program, we're maybe at best, we can count on 100 fairly active people. How do you evangelize 150,000 if you just stay within Huntington Beach? But of course you go to Fountain Valley as well.
You determine your target.
Yeah.
You determine your target, and congregations aren't doing that. We're called to go out and win the world for Jesus Christ. Well, that makes no sense at all. You have to decide where, and you have to decide who. And also who you're going to leave out. And every church does that. Every congregation does that. On top of the table or below it. If you don't have signing, you're telling the deaf person they're not welcome here. If you've got steps to climb up and you're not dealing with that kind of thing, you're telling the person who has problems, with mobility, that they're not welcome here. Those are the signals that are being shared in all size churches, I guess, not only small.
I guess church you described is like my hometown church back in West Virginia when I was raised. 125 people, almost unrelated. There's many generations there. It's been around for 100 years, I guess. It's different probably than what we have in California.
I'm thinking that because I think we belong to a small congregation now, although I would never have said that before coming. We belong to University Lutheran Church in Cambridge, which has a sort of a very small core of people who live there who aren't students, some of whom are faculty, that sort of extends over time, and then this sort of large group of students that come and go and come and go. So we have this rotating group, and in the summer we dwindle down and find out who we really are, is the way it says. We have church picnics, and we're very small. I think one of the differences between our church and yours is this church is older, so there is somewhat of a tradition and a history. I think one of the distinctions may be the 15 years old versus an older congregation, and I think then you might get some pillars, some people who have always been there, and some sort of different dynamics might emerge. But I would argue that we're actually two congregations. We've had a lot of trouble integrating the two congregations. The difference is that we happen to draw on Harvard Divinity School and a lot of other very sophisticated talents, so we don't lack the leadership and sophistication that your definition of the small congregation has, and we tend to be sort of overwhelmed with.
One of my theses that would be even more basic than the ones we've talked about, and you're all agreeing with that, is that you just cannot categorize congregations. Mm-hmm. Extremely unique, special, and we have done too much of that in the past. And now we're doing it again in terms of small, but that's meant just to, to kind of break that open so we can see that. And there would be a number of ways of looking at that, programmatically in terms of evangelism or attitude or community. So
that last point is the point that bothers me a lot, is that as Bob was saying, we live in a huge metropolitan area where people pack together like fishing like sardines, I need to get everything. But the trouble is that we have is that we work in different places. We are busy at different high schools. And it's pretty difficult to get a sense of community. Yeah.
But I would say that's true even in the churches that I'm talking about, those two things, in terms of at least 80% of the churches I'm talking about, different schools, working in different places. So even in a very rural area, that's beginning to affect very sharp and very rapid change in that regard. And it's one of the problems that we're having to deal with. If anybody that moved out of a rural area as recently as 15 years ago and hasn't really been reading and studying carefully is totally out of touch with what rural America is today.
Back to this community, why we don't feel we have a community in our church, because there are so many things going on in the little town that draw people away. And I've had the idea that in a larger city, the church is kind of expensive.
I don't think that I could support that, but I would not want to go to the other extreme either. I have served in very small, medium, large, whatever you want to define. And I would say the toughest job we had in terms of, from many perspectives at least, in getting people together was in the medium-sized city. It was easier almost in the suburb than there, because there were a limited number of people that were expected to do everything. And the pressure on those, and that's what I'm guessing Beach is, the pressure on those people to be involved in the hospital auxiliary and the extra time at work and the church and on and on and on and on was just very, very, very powerful.
Develop further, if you could, the concept you were talking about a bit earlier about many comparatively small churches reaching an average of membership and without much movement up or down, and you can even leave the paid clergy out of it for a while and they still stay at the same number.
The small congregation tends to maintain itself but tends not to reach out or grow. It has to test. I'm really pushing this hard. It has to test every person to see if he or she is safe to bring in.
I'd like to ask.
The more dissimilar the person is, unless that person is going to be a mascot, the Vietnamese family, it's in to bring in a family, that's safe. But generally, they're kept out. The congregation will tend to grow from within, from very safe people. In order to break out of that, you have to be willing to divide yourself or add new cells.
What do you find with the changeover of pastors in a small, non-growing type of church? There's a couple questions I have related to this, and maybe you can develop those. Number one is, does that cause a drop in membership or a changeover membership? Is this the convenient time to drop out, the excuse we've been looking for? And the second thing does it seem like the new pastor has to adapt into the mold that's already formed, as opposed to bringing in any new ideas
yes,
at all?
Yes.
And does anything ever evolve from that?
Rule of thumb is that if a pastor is not willing to give 5 to 6 years in a small congregation, nothing is going to happen during his or her pastorate. And of course, again, you see what the church has done. Upward mobility there, as in many other places, and pulls these people out. And after 3 years has been the rule of thumb. We've moved that, tried it to 4. In Minnesota in recent years. On the other side of it, the pastor as a key to what goes on in the parish seems to be more intense in the large congregation than in the small. The small congregation knows all kinds of ways of working around the pastor. Unless he or she comes in as a dictator, and there will be ways that the community will work with that too. Julie?
We heard an alternate rule of thumb. When we were in the Bronx, our congregation had had a minister for 25 years and was in a changing neighborhood, and we watched the church go from traditional old German immigrants to become quite well integrated blacks and beginning to be Hispanic. And the rule of thumb there was to change a congregation, what you have is one person who's been there a long time, one person comes for a very short time, and then becomes sort of a focus of a lot of the anger and the resentment and the change, and then you bring in someone, and the congregation is ready to move on.
Yeah, that's
and it's
fair.
Sort of this middle person sort of takes all the heat.
The lightning rod. Yeah.
The flak catcher.
Yeah.
And that was presented to us as sort of, you know, this is the way it is.
Yeah, I would just hope that the people would have dealt with that in terms of the pastor when he or she came in too. Because usually the way it happens is that that's a carefully kept secret. And then you destroy somebody. Can we quickly look at, we're not going to have time for Roman 3, which is fine, but let me just pull out a couple things in terms of advantages. And I knew we'd get stuck here, because we always do, and as I say, even in our own office, we can't agree. And this has been very helpful feedback and kind of a reality test to me, so thank you for that. These are generalities again, as the other was. I don't want them to be concretized, but I think they're generally true. We've already talked about one of the pluses, and that is that the small congregation tends to get along on less maintenance, less leadership than the large congregation. Again, you'd have to here not compare Silver Creek, Minnesota with Huntington Beach. You'd have to compare in your own context. Second thing that I find quite interesting is that the smaller the church, the larger the percentage of participation. The larger the congregation, the smaller the percentage of participation. Very rare does that not follow. And in my own experience, I've served four congregations, 186 members, average Sunday attendance of 72%. 322 member church, 59% average attendance. 1,100 member congregation, 36%. A 1,300 member congregation, 19% average Sunday attendance. Now there's a lot else that fits into that, but I think generally speaking that is fair. The small congregation tends to have more informal ways of caring for one another. Again, rural and urban may change this some, but I still think that the smaller the congregation, the more involved a grapevine network there tends to be. And you just find out about stuff. No big announcement necessarily. In my experience, again, there was a death of a farmer in this 86-member congregation, and one day I went out to see Hattie. And all the men were there. The women had brought food and were doing stuff, and the men were all there taking the crop up. I didn't even know that that was going to happen. Now, we had a triple murder-suicide in the members, in the 1,300-member church, and I had to work like crazy to get help from the church to go in there. It was all there, you know, but it took some shaping to get it to happen. It had to be institutionalized, in other words. The small congregation tends to be more naturally intergenerational. If you don't have older folk in the community, of course, that's not going to happen. The church tends to take the shape of the community in terms of age, tilt a little bit more older, and tilt a little bit more toward female than male. Interesting that our women pastors in Minnesota are reaching more males, and their congregation would not be typical LCA congregations because they'd have more than 46.5% males in them. So we're learning some things about that. The small congregation, we'll stop with this one and then we can chat a little bit more if you have some interest, is more adaptable. There's more flexibility in programming and in space. They make do. They have to. I suppose it's forced. But you don't have a ladies' parlor, for instance, where there are only four keys and you got to get to the pastor or the janitor or the LCW president or that one other key person that has a key to get in. You just don't have that. You just use the space you have, and a lot fewer problems tend to develop. Although, again, you don't have that lovely space to use either. Maybe you have some more pluses or some more minuses. Last week, somebody shared a number 17 that I added to my plus list. Or other comments?
I think one of the minuses I was trying to allude to before about the different schools. Again, I think back to my own hometown in West Virginia, where we had one high school. But I think we have multiple high schools, and to get a youth program going is difficult.
Well, in my town,
I don't see the other, yeah, other kids except on Sunday.
Yeah, but that's all over the place. In the town we lived in, of 130 people, we had 6 high schools. That's the typical. Even with all the consolidation, that's what we dealt with. And 3 telephone exchanges. That was the one of the ones I shared.
That's nice town.
130 people. Well, all the kids in town went to one, but in terms of our parish, it wasn't that large. They went to Wells, Alden, Conger, Emmons, Keister, Bryceland. How many did I list?
6.
Okay.
There are many advantages to a small parish, and I wouldn't be in one if I didn't think that were true, and I wouldn't be in ours if I didn't think it were true in our parish. The disadvantage is thinking of all of the advantages and all the good things that we're doing. Why come we're not bigger? Why don't more people see that and join in? And you begin to question yourself a little bit about, well, you know, why aren't more people into that? Therefore, am I wrong by seeing, I have belonged to the largest LCMS church in Southern California, and there is a value in knowing that, yeah, we keep attracting, we've got 2,000, 3,000, how many members have been there? But you must be doing something right. There are 800 people at a worship service, I believe, or, you know, the congregation, I believe, yeah, okay, well, all these people, yeah. But if you've got 75 or 100 people, that I believe isn't all that powerful, and you begin to think,
no, I'm not going to dispute that. I think, but I would not want you to put a value, good or bad, on that. Different, and deal with what makes one way and what makes the other way. I could celebrate that. It sounds as though you're interested in reaching out. And that's one of the pitfalls, and we could talk about that too if we had more time. Small congregations tend not to reach out even where there is opportunity, and it sounds as though your congregation is at least open to that.
But then too, do we want to reach out because we really want to serve the other people, or do we reach out because we feel we're kind of small and we've got a good thing, and to substantiate the fact that we do have a good one, we ought to get more people in?
People tend not to join churches if they have any feeling that they're needed, or shall we say, if they're being used to pay off debt, or to become larger, or to add a new organ, or to, you know,
fill a choir, or whatever.
Right. Well, thank you much.